that's John Lennon. We chose that the power to the people because we think of Tom Power, our dear friend, and he would have believed, did believe in that very concept. I'm sure he liked John Lennon very, very much. And this is CIOT, the Taylor Report. We're going to be talking shortly with Steve Gowans, who has a new book coming out. The book is titled Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. Phil, do you have the announcement about
that?
Maybe you don't.
Yeah, I do. It's on May 16th at a different book list, 777 Bathurst at 7 p.m. There's a lot of sevens. And Stephen Gowans will be there to promote his book on May the 16th.
Yeah. And you can assume that this subject of the talk, by the way, by the time Stephen comes here on the 16th, this matter of Trump and the North Korean leader is going to be very much a hot item. So you want to turn out in great numbers and get a copy of Stephen's book. And I think Stephen's with us on the line. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes. Hello, Phil.
I'm sorry we had a little delay getting to you. We had gremlins today. Once in a while we get visited by gremlins. But Stephen, we were just talking to Rick Sterling in the Bay Area, who's followed all this matter of Syria for many years, and you have been writing about it. You have on the 8th, you published a piece discussing what is taking place with Syria. And you listed 8 things that you say that the world ought to know about in analyzing this peculiar story. By the way, a year ago we had the same story, that mm-hmm. something had happened and something had to be done. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe I better ask you a risk assessment before I get to the numbers. How dangerous is this situation in your view?
I suppose it's dangerous because Trump, and I'm going to say the U.S. government, but Trump is blaming this unverified chemical attack on not only on the Syrian government, but also on the Iranians and the Russians.
Mm-hmm. We all worry that, they seem to make this, very often you get the idea that they have a habit of saying, well, it's March, it's time to hit somebody with something, and they have the idea that they will always be able to put their paw in and take it out. But there is a chance, given what Russia has been saying, Iran has been saying, and even Syria, they might get themselves caught. It strikes me as extremely dangerous to assume that Russia won't do something if they tell you they're going to do it. Rick Sterling just told us, for example, that Russia said, we understand that there might be an attack on Syria some month ago. And they said, if we want them to know, anybody contemplating that they will be, it won't just be the missiles or planes, it will be countered, but it'll the source of that. So it underlines the importance of your, excuse me, your perspective. But you said that there's a couple of things wrong here. They haven't established really that anything happened, right?
No.
And go ahead.
No, I mean, even the British Foreign Office has said the reports are unverified. The U.S. State Department says they're unconfirmed. The New York Times says it's not possible to independently verify the reports. And yet, I mean, this is all acknowledged, and yet the U.S. government and the U.K. government and the French government say Assad must be held responsible. Mm-hmm. But that's the usual pattern. Unverified claims are made, and immediately they're accepted by the U.S. government and other governments as verified, when in fact they're not. And we know they're not because we could suspect they're not because there's never been evidence presented, no compelling evidence from credible sources. But at a February 2nd news conference, the U.S. Defense Secretary, Jim Mattis, acknowledged that there has never been any evidence for any of these alleged chemical weapons attacks by the Syrian government. He said, I mean, just to quote him, "No, I have not got the evidence, not specifically, I don't have the evidence. What I'm saying is that groups on the ground, NGOs, fighters on the ground have said that sarin was used, so we're looking for evidence, but I don't have it."
Mm-hmm. That's very striking. But again, this article is at gowans.wordpress.com, 8 reasons why the latest Syrian chemical weapons attack allegations are almost certainly complete nonsense. And, you know, you just quoted the man who, his nickname is Mad Dog. Mm-hmm. And if the Mad Dog says, "I don't have evidence," that would seem to be reason to pause. A question that flows in that, too, in my mind is, under what authority does the United States or that place called Great Britain or France have, how can they initiate anything? Under international law, under treaties, under the United Nations Charter? Where do they get off talking about doing anything in Syria?
Yes, I know. I saw a headline just a few hours ago that said that Trump says he'll decide what he's going to do later today, as if he somehow has the authority to make decisions, as if the West is the moral guarantor or the guarantor of some moral international order. And you're right. I mean, what business is it of his? And moreover, what moral authority does the United States have, or Britain, or France? They have no moral authority at all. Mm-hmm. France seems to be rehabilitating its colonial past here. It wants to, or is very eager to get involved in Syria, mm-hmm. On completely spurious grounds. Mad Dog acknowledged that there's no evidence, but everyone always acknowledges that there's no evidence. They're always quite upfront about this. I mean, the State Department's upfront about it. The British Foreign Office is upfront about it. All the major newspapers are upfront about it. They say there's no evidence, but then they recede as if, in fact, it's the Syrian government that is guilty as charged.
Yeah. By the way, isn't that also part of the hubris of empire? Is it? Well, we don't have evidence, but we don't need it. You know, our intuition told us you did it, so that's enough, and we smack you. In leading into this, there's a headline from the New York Times that fits into your 8 pieces. It says, "As Trump seeks way out of Syria, new attack pulls him back in." one of the things you quote cite in the 8 theses is that, in a way, it's just a way to rationalize, further engagement, this chemical attack. In other words, in terms of suspicion as to, and I don't know why I'm calling it a chemical attack, it hasn't been shown to be one, but all they need is a little thing like this, and he gets to do a U-turn and one assumes he'll escalate the amount of violence this time.
And I mean, if you look at who are the parties involved in bringing these reports forward, they're hardly impartial parties. They're parties that have an interest in this conflict. The reports were brought forward by groups that have an interest in discrediting the Syrian government and providing a pretext for continued or escalating U.S. military intervention in Syria. Mm-hmm. They are the White Helmets, one of the groups, and the Syrian American Medical Society is the other. Both are allied with the Islamist insurgents who are attempting to overthrow the Syrian government. Both operate exclusively within Islamist-controlled areas, so no group operates within these areas that's not allied with or under the control of the jihadists. There are no New York Times reporters there or CNN reporters. And what's more, these groups are funded by Western governments, which also have an interest in discrediting the Syrian government. So the White Helmets are funded by the United States, by Canada, the UK, New Zealand, Denmark, and the Netherlands, and the Syrian American Medical Society is funded by the U.S. government, specifically U.S. Agency for International Development. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they have an interest. There is obviously some consternation when Trump started musing about withdrawing or ending the U.S. occupation of one-third or almost one-third of Syrian territory. Certainly the Pentagon reacted immediately. We can imagine, I think quite reasonably, that the Islamist insurgents were very unhappy with that, and their allies, the White Helmets and the Syrian American Medical Society, were unhappy with it. And as the New York Times pointed out, this provided a dilemma to Trump. Here is Trump wanting to end the occupation, and now suddenly there's pressure on him to continue. Mm-hmm. So these groups had a motivation to fabricate some kind of atrocity which would force Trump's hand and impel him or compel him to agree to this continued occupation, which the Pentagon and other significant figures in the U.S. foreign policy establishment have been arguing for.
Yeah. This is Steve Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. The article is published on the 8th of April. You go into the matter. So many people, some of our better leaders have done raise this point, which you talk about, which is, where's the motive? How could Syria benefit from such an act?
Right. I mean, the White Helmets and the Islamists and the Pentagon benefit from this, but how does the Syrian government benefit? This would be manifestly self-defeating, and therefore it would seem to be highly unlikely. I mean, the Syrian Arab Army is on the cusp of an all-but-inevitable victory in eastern Ghouta. So why would it cancel its gains by handing the United States a pretext to continue its military intervention in Syria in the aftermath of Trump signaling his intention to withdraw U.S. troops? Makes absolutely no sense.
Mm-hmm. And you also take up another matter, which is very much related, and that is chemical weapons are not efficient. They're dangerous. They're hard to – and go back to the word efficient. Why would anybody use them?
It's difficult to conceive of any military benefit of deploying the chemical weapons. If you want to kill people, then you can use lethal conventional ways. I mean, because chemical weapons, the effects are unpredictable, and they're typically small scale. So in all the alleged chemical attack incidents in Syria, for which there was never any evidence, mm-hmm. that Syrian government was responsible. I mean, the claim number of victims is always smaller than that which could easily be produced by airstrikes and artillery. So why would the Syrian government use relatively ineffective chemical weapons, thereby mm-hmm. creating a pretext for continued U.S. intervention, when they could use much more deadly conventional weapons without crossing a red line?
Yes.
So if we assume they're complete morons, well, maybe the scenario is believable, but then we'd have to be complete morons to believe the scenario.
Yes. Well, yes, and by the way, as you've pointed out in the past, and Rick Sterling pointed out earlier, you can watch these leaders, and there is a consensus that Trump is very nearly mental and irrational, and whereas anybody who's watched President Assad of Syria has noticed that he's a careful person. He speaks in sentences and paragraphs, and he remembers his points. And that being the case, it doesn't strike you as being the person who would do anything so foolish. One could believe it of Trump, actually, now that I've mentioned. But Assad is a very sober individual. And apropos of that, you point out your seventh point was that Syria has been the only party to all of this that's been checked out by the organization empowered to do so on the issue of possession of chemical weapons.
Yeah, I mean, in 2014, Syria eliminated its chemical weapons stock in cooperation with the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons. Well, we have these conversations, and we implicitly assume that they actually have chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. They don't, or at least...
Well, yes, and by the way, that was agreed to, right? I remember months went by, and they said this many tons have been destroyed, and that was under supervision, and it was... The parties agreed that it, the chemical weapons, chemical materials had been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
We could point out, by the way, the U.S. is under a treaty and agreement to get rid of its chemical stock and has yet to do so.
Yes, yet to do so, and yet it's well overdue.
I think they've stopped promising, haven't they?
Pardon me? Yeah, they keep putting it off.
Yeah. Well, I want to make sure we ask you something. By the way, we're planning on seeing you here on May the 16th at 7 p.m. I don't know if you know that. I want you to know the different book list has got you scheduled for May the 16th. And this is going to be the matter of Korea, your book, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, the story of Korea's struggle for freedom. This business of the attack and all the excitement between Russia, the United States, et cetera, are you wondering whether this will impact on the planned meeting between Kim Jong-un and Trump?
I suppose it might. I haven't given that much thought.
An aspect of it I want to make sure I ask you. The way they're playing the story is sort of like, well, Kim is giving up. The headlines on the papers say he's agreed to put nuclear weapons on the table. Was there a time he wasn't?
No. But that's the impression they give is that he's going there to surrender.
Yeah, because the Superman can't meet with the other guy unless the other guy – takes a knee or something, right?
Exactly. But I mean, if you read some of the articles really carefully, I mean, there's some concern in Washington about, well, when he said denuclearization, maybe he expects something from the United States in return. Oh, I hope not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one is, yeah. My impression reading it is that, of course, it is what already has been agreed to. Everybody agrees it would be best, well, everybody who doesn't want to be blown up, that there be no nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula and no weaponry that would, you know, threat to the neighbors, et cetera, and that would be the starting point. It's not anybody making a concession, provided they all agree that would be desirable.
Yeah. There's one person in the U.S. foreign policy establishment pointed out quite correctly, though, you can't really legitimately talk about denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula without talking about the nuclear umbrella that the United States provides to South Korea.
Mm-hmm. And, I'll make you the negotiator. What would North Korea be saying to them about what they... And China, by the way. China is a player. Russia is a player. They're all within the range of these new weapons. So what do they propose to the U.S.?
Well, I mean, there's a fear within the foreign policy establishment that Kim, when he says denuclearization, expects significant concessions on the part of the United States. And there seems to be absolutely no willingness to provide any concession at all. They want to regard these talks as essentially a capitulation on the part of the North Koreans. You end your nuclear program, and maybe we'll lift a few sanctions. And that would be then a replay of what's happened with Iran.
mm-hmm.
You know.
We're about to be bailing out on what had been at least a semi-rational agreement.
Yes, and Iran didn't get that much from agreeing to curb its civilian nuclear program.
Yeah,
I mean, still, the United States continued to maintain very heavy sanctions on Iran, or continues to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I point out the Secretary of Defense is named Mad Dog again, and Bolton has joined the team. Stephen Gowans, it's been great talking to you. You've got a wonderful book, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, A Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom. And, of course, this article can be on April the 8th, gowans.wordpress.com. And we look forward to seeing you here. We hope we maybe talk to you before as the we get closer to the Trump-Kim Jong-un meeting. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah. See you. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM.